my privilege now to introduce to you Jim McDaniel, Secretary for Black Ministry, Board for Mission Services, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, who will be introducing our first speaker.
Thank you, Professor Kapiski. I too would like to bring my greetings to you all for attending this historic event here at the Seminary of Concordia. We are really grateful to God that you have taken the time out of your busy schedules to be here and to help us all together, along with the faculty and students, find better ways in which we can help serve and share the gospel of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ to the many thousands of blacks in North America who do not know him. Our first presenter is a good friend of mine, also a fellow classmate. As printed in the Vita, as you see in your packets, the Reverend James R. Thomas was born in Louisiana. And as you see, he has attended various schools in our system. But most recently, he has been conferred the doctorate of ministry degree in pastoral counseling from the Graduate Theological Foundation at Notre Dame, Indiana, just last week. He is also presently a PhD candidate at the University of Minnesota in Education, Psychology, and Urban Studies. Dr. Thomas is presently serving the Church of the as the assistant to the bishop of the Minnesota Senate, Metropolitan Minnesota Senate of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. Dr. Thomas has many different and unique opportunities to share with us, and we are grateful that he was able, out of his busy schedule, to come and present to us on the topic of Lutheran traditions and the black culture. Let us warmly welcome the Reverend Dr. James R. Thomas.
My brothers and sisters in Christ, I greet you in the name of the one who saves and liberates us all by giving his all. When I was contacted some time ago and asked to speak today, I was at once excited, reluctant, surprised, and yes, humbled. The invitation was offered somewhat in this vein. James, we would like for you to make a major presentation. That was exciting. We would like for you to talk about Lutheran tradition and the black culture. I was reluctant. But then I was told that I was replacing former American Lutheran Church Bishop Nelson Trout. And the question that arose in my mind was a question that people ask me all the time. They say, James, what does an assistant to the bishop do? And I said, anything the bishop can't or does not want to do. Bishop Trout would have certainly liked to have been here with us today, but some months ago he had a heart attack, and I certainly do not consider myself in the league that he's in. Nelson Trout is a family member. He is what I've come to call an elder. For me, people like Peter Font and Moses Dickinson were also my elders. And we all should have ones whom we honor, patriarchs or matriarchs, if you will. And Nelson has certainly been that for me. On the lighter side, I was asked when the notice of this meeting was published in our Senate bulletin, why on earth would Concordia Seminary invite James Thomas to speak? I thought, well, maybe they were just jealous for asking that question. But it reminded me of a neighbor I used to have up in Harlem, when I lived in Harlem, who used to raise this one cat, C-A-T. And one day he was sitting down reading the Amsterdam News, and there was posted in the Amsterdam News an international cat show. He said, I know what I'm going to enter my feline in that show. And his wife said, you can't enter your cat in that show. Don't you know that there are Persian cats and there are cats from Japan and Russia and there are hybrid cats from all over the world in that show? You can't really expect your cat to win anything or impress anybody, do you? And he said, no, I don't expect that at all, but the exposure will certainly help him. And I thank you for the exposure. Within the broad and diversified panorama of African-American Christian expression, Black Lutherans have, in the view of some, always stuck out as slightly peculiar. Lutheran theologian Albert Perot of the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago once described us as an invisible movement within the church. Not an invisible church, as the Black church has been termed, and certainly not anything approaching the church, but an invisible movement, if you will, an invisible current. Undocumented, unresearched largely, largely uninvolved in ongoing conversation and dialogue. Written about in sometimes unflattering mission reports, at times when there were celebrations of milestones, or in support of mission efforts in particular Lutheran groups. Lutheran historian Martin Marty, writing about the discipline of historiography in his book, A Nation of Behaviors, could be talking about Black Lutherans when he writes, most of what has happened to them has been lost from view. And historians not free to write fiction or engage in pure guesses have to fall silent unless they have substantial surviving clues as evidence that something occurred with these people and in a certain way. One of the challenges facing people who are interested in documenting a Black experience in Lutheranism, especially in the United States of America, one of the challenges is that of digging out the surviving clues and holding them up for inspection and critical examination, establishing the fact that something did happen, something worth talking about, something worth writing about, something worth celebrating. Yes, there were people back there who we can write whole books about, who had the color of skin that I have, who've not been honored because we have not done the job. There are good reasons for researching a Black Lutheran experience. First of all, for Black people in particular, it connects us with the flow of history. Believe it or not, it connects us with our Black cultural heritage. A large part of our problem today as Black Lutherans is that our own heritage is often shut off from us as we are forced to vicariously experience the Lutheran Danish settlements of 1673 in St. Thomas and the Lutheran settlers who came to the Dutch colony of the New Netherlands in 1623 and the Lutheran Salzburgers who settled in Georgia in 1734. Those are who we study as seminary students and as professional church workers. Rarely, as
seminary students, are we going to be exposed to our black selves? Rarely will the white seminarian be exposed to much about black life and history. It's no wonder that many of us have serious identity crises as pastors in the church. Yes, we have serious identity crises. There can be no people without a culture. Separate people from their cultural heritage and the people themselves will wound up with serious problems. Beyond that, we seriously dishonor those men and women who have suffered, who have worked, who have faithfully labored in ministries of word and sacrament, and as lay ministers in life, when we do not recall their mighty and their less noticeable acts of faith. If I were to ask you today, who was Christopher Drews, some of you would know. Some might be able to talk about Henry Melchior Muhlenberg. All of you had better know who C.F.W. Walther and Franz Fieber was. But how many of you today would legitimately be able to say, I can tell you about Yehu Jones, and I can tell you a great deal about this person? How often is Yehu Jones mentioned in a classroom at a Lutheran seminary? Is it important to our history as Lutheran churches that at some point in history, in 1832 to be exact, the first black man was ordained a pastor in the Lutheran Church in America? Should that be something that we celebrate? That was 1 year after Nat Turner's slave insurrection. It connects you with something that was going on at the same time. You're putting people into a historical context. They don't just drop into a Lutheran mission book as though nothing were going on around them in the greater world in which they live. That was 10 years after Denmark Vesey's movement on the historical stage. A young man named Yehu Jones received a call into the ministry. He belonged to a congregation, St. John's Lutheran Church in Charleston, South Carolina, where he paid $10 a year for a pew up in the balcony because his family was one of the free ones, and he was a tailor. In 1832, Jones received a letter of recommendation from his pastor, the Reverend John Bachman, and set out for a journey to New York City where he intended to seek ordination from the New York Ministerium. And that was because South Carolina Lutherans did not ordain blacks at that time. He reached New York somewhat late, but he did meet a group of pastors who had not left for home yet, and they constituted themselves into a body, and they ordained him. He was ordained the first black Lutheran pastor. He worked and later organized several congregations around about Philadelphia, but the one that came to something was St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Philadelphia. And had the climate been a better climate than it was for black Lutherans when Yehu Jones came through, we might look at St. Paul's Lutheran Church today and say that's the oldest black Lutheran church in America. But unfortunately, that did not happen. Jones lingered on with lamentable experiences, and by 1849, he was gone. White historians, with few exceptions, and I think here of Pastor Tom Noon and Douglas Strange, who worked at Harvard University in the library, and a missionary by the name of Jans Larson, but white Lutheran historians, with few exceptions within Lutheranism, have largely ignored the presence of black Lutherans within the body of their historical writing. It would not be incorrect or immodest to suggest, have been that invisible movement within Lutheranism in North America. The blacks have suffered elsewhere. The stories of Yehu Jones and Daniel Payne and Boston Drayton and Sam Holt and Nathan Clapp and William Pfeiffer and Rosa J. Young, all of these stories must be rescued and told so as to give identity and meaning to the rest of us and to honor those people. Ultimately, we remember them as gifts of God in the mission of the church. Ultimately, when we remember those people, we say, well, maybe some of them could not make it, but maybe our tolerance level is a little bit higher in 1989, and we're going to stay. Around the turn of the century, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote about the general paradox of black life in America in the book, The Souls of Black Folks. Here's a quote from that book. It is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body. His dog strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. It could be a fair description, not only of black Lutherans, but of black people in society, in the world today. It reminds us that black Lutheran thought is not the same as the European Lutheran thought or white Lutheran thought. Nor is it identical with traditional African beliefs. At its best, it should relate to both. On the one hand, the Lutheran doctrine of justification by grace through faith, apart from works of the law, given a lot of people who have been quite hopeless and quite voiceless, who've been broken down without strength and without courage. A doctrine like that has given them a great deal of reason to hope. Doctrines like theology of the cross has helped to interpret our suffering and pain and given us the extra strength to go along. It's given us meaning and direction and definition in life. Oh, our Lutheran side is something that is important to us. But we've also been shaped by the legacy of our slave experience. And that is an experience that is quite different from the society in which we find ourselves a minority part of. Our thinking, unlike that of whites, is shaped by the ever-impacting force of racism upon us daily. But there are some other forces that are impacting upon us
impacting upon the churches that we call Lutheran, that are located in proximity to other Lutheran churches that may be located in every urban center in the nation today. And I'll tell you that the forces that are going on and stirring around where those churches are shaping the members and the people who would like to be members in ways that are quite different from that of the larger white culture outside of that community. Today, in cities across the nation, our identities are being shaped by an increase in social isolation, for example. In social isolation, we are being shaped by the impact of social dislocation, crime, joblessness, out-of-wedlock births, female-headed households, welfare dependency, a growing subculture in our cities that are quite different in behavior and in lifestyle, growing up around our churches. And that's shaping our thinking in a totally different way. We are going to be quite different when we come together with our white brothers and sisters. Our thinking is impacted by the extraordinary increase in the poor, especially the black poor, during the decade from 1970 to 1980. I contend that it is the black side, the black Lutheran side of our Christian faith, or if you will, our African side, or the contextual side of our faith, which enables us to see beyond the constraints placed upon us by the culture and the times. This is a side we need vitally to connect our local ministries to, our local congregations to. We've got to connect them up with the experiences of the people we hope to invite into our space. Historically, while black Methodists and Baptists were, in the words of Methodist, United Methodist historian William B. McCain, while they were refashioning or contextualizing the Christian message, as they made great strides in interpreting that message in their mission outreach to a people struggled for justice. Black Lutherans have often shown a tendency to cling to a rigid conservatism, and I'm not speaking of a theological conservatism, where they put themselves in a position which found them defending, for example, liturgical and pastoral practices which were fashionable, I dare say they were even useful, in white churches around them. While blacks in the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church and some black Presbyterians were expressing some amount of preference or tolerance even to spontaneity and less inhibited worship styles, with stirring music that was sure to generate religious emotions, black Lutherans clung to Western types of music, often outdoing their white brothers and sisters in rendering, for example, the Psalms in four-part Anglican chant. As other black Christians have sought to move their churchly expressions, Roman Catholics,
included, as they have sought to move their worship from theology, or I'm talking about God talk, and preaching toward the experiences and particular social predicament of their memberships, or of the people in their neighborhood, maybe not so much the membership, because, well, our membership are often people who've climbed a little bit. African-American Lutherans have been unable to see the equation between the vitality of their church life and the worship that accompanies it, and the everyday circumstances of those who we would invite to worship with us. This has led to a very real dilemma for African-American Lutheran congregations. The current situation of African-American Lutheranism becomes quite disquieting, even serious, if we ask the question, how will Lutheranism's presence in the African-American community be sustained? Kind of pricing question. How will the presence be sustained in light of what we all know, who pastor churches in those communities? We all know what's happening. It used to hurt me to my heart when somebody moved to another city. They might hurt a white pastor in a congregation somewhere else too. But I knew how hard or difficult it would be getting somebody to replace that person. The question need not be answered with complete pessimism, yet the present condition of African-American Lutheranism hardly allows many answers of positive heartiness. Somebody asked me how long was I going to take. I think that was Fraser Odom. I'm going to go till I finish, Fraser. As Black Lutherans in America celebrate, and I was reminding the people in Concordia Historical Institute today that they really ought to do something about this, as we celebrate the centennial of the founding of the Alpha Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Freedmen in America, May 8, 1889, or what roughly equates to a Black Lutheran denomination, it would seem to be a good time to discuss an African-American Lutheran congregation this idea about creating an authentic expression of the community out of which this congregation emerges. The African-American Lutheran community must engage the ever-creeping rigidity in worship style. Yes, I think so, but it's just my opinion. I want you all to know that everything I say today is my opinion. Yes, I think that we ought to not be upset when there is spontaneity in worship. The reserved style of, in my denomination, the Lutheran Book of Worship, and yours, which is similar, centers an undue amount of mental concentration on ritual, I think, without giving due attention to substance. It creates the impression that worship is fully defined only in terms of what we do, when in fact, it is first and foremost our response to what God has done. Not simply for Christians, but for all in and outside of the church. We concentrate so much on what we do and how we do it, rather than on what has already been done for us. The African-American Lutheran congregation can also benefit by divesting the gospel of all of the European cultural fabric which has been
fit in such a way that it all seems to be one with the message.
Western cultural elements seem from time to time well placed in some of the Minnesota congregations I visit. They're all white. And they're doing well because it's all very appropriate to the communities I preach in. In black communities, cultural elements ought to reflect the setting in which the people find themselves. Black Lutheran congregations, especially in poor neighborhoods, in the cities, those caught often in bourgeois captivity and a system of value which sets them apart from the masses around them, successful anecdotes notwithstanding, will find it hard to engage in successful evangelism. I know, I've been pastor of a couple of those churches. One of the first hurdles which African Americans encounter in Lutheran music, in Lutheran worship is music. White Lutherans, we can say, have been at best oblivious to the contributions of blacks in music. This has led to a suppression of African American hymnology in Lutheran congregations. And while we can still see the stamp of the black experience clearly marked on some Euro-American hymns, we will almost never hear authentic African-American songs in Lutheran churches. Songs such as "Old Freedom," "Go Down Moses," "Steal Away to Jesus," "Is There Anybody Here Who Loves My Jesus?" These songs remain beyond the realm of our worship, but yet they are clarion calls to the 17 million black Christians in America today who flood the churches with brothers denominations. By the way, it would appear, according to statistics, that an overwhelming majority of black Christians in America today belong to black churches. Worship is still very segregated. An overwhelming majority of black Christians today belong to black denominations, but the black Christians who are in white denominations belong overwhelmingly to black congregations. Yes, that is the truth. We have to realize where we are. In many of our congregations, we often express a preference for so-called classical music. Thus, Handel's Messiah and other German, Welsh, Dutch, English, Scottish, French, Italian, and others are selected over songs like "Every Time I Feel the Spirit Moving in My Heart." Lutheran musicians seem to be unaware that on the continent of Africa, there is a growing Lutheran population that will eventually, if it continues to grow, outnumber any other Lutheran population in the world. And that population is producing some beautiful liturgical, musical expressions that's written down and available for our hearing and edification. Things are changing. In prayer, we pray for everybody and all sorts of issues, but we're slow to allow our prayers to rise out of our condition. As Wyatt Walker has written, the subject and content of black prayer ought to be set by the conditions around us. In preaching, I don't think that any of the pastors who are being trained at Concordia Seminary or at
Luther Northwestern, where I teach, are being trained to be pastors of white congregations. The preacher does have the task of relating the Bible message to the circumstances of the audience. Black clergy should have a hand, I think, in teaching and preaching. I'm getting close to the end now, in case you are getting nervous. How will Lutheranism's presence in the African-American community be sustained? It would be a gross oversimplification to say that we can or have even captured a small part of the solution in this presentation. I believe that Lutherans will have to become more conscious of the cultural contexts of the black congregations and the black communities where we will set up missions, replacing Western cultural elements arranged around the gospel with black cultural elements is a good starting point. Lutherans know well that the gospel is about the redemptive power of the risen Christ, and that is the core for all of us. Music and worship forms, art and architecture are all secular and most often cultural components. And they are propagated as if they were the gospel. We should be more than a little concerned and offended. It was a church in confusion about itself, its mission, and its message which led Luther, contrary to all of his inclinations, into rebellion against the papacy. Something should also be said about the training of black candidates for the ministry. For the most part, they're not being, again, educated to serve in white congregations. At some juncture, some select black clergy and lay people ought to have some meaningful part in their educational development. All training should not be comprised of on-campus experiences, even. I'm so glad that the president of ITC is going to be here. I would even suggest that black seminarians especially, but also whites who will serve in black congregations, have exposure to schools like ITC and Howard University Divinity School, where real issues surface that relate to the contextual experience of the congregation we're being called to. In preaching classes, it goes without saying that blacks are again not being prepared to preach in black congregations. If it is true that the preacher has a responsibility of relating the Bible message to the circumstances of the hearers, then it is essential that experienced black preachers again have a hand in teaching homiletics. No prediction can be made here about the future of Lutheranism in African-American communities, but it is possible to suggest how a rapid decline may set in. If we continue what Richard Kimmerer, who was taught here, once called culture strutting, we continue to do that in the face of a totally different need. If we continue to do what we have been doing for the last umpteen numbers of years in cities that are radically changing, and I say cities simply because statistically most black people in America live in cities. Fact. If we continue to do the kinds of things that we have been doing, it is quite predictable that my children are going to be Baptists or Methodists, because they may not find a great deal of meaning in the congregation that I'm pastor. Finally, when we recognize some of this and other things that come to your own mind, you find that we have less need of familiar places and customs to realize our individual and corporate identities. We become as a pilgrim people, finding new companions in our life journeys from every race and nation and from every social stratum. We then find ourselves in community where no particular manner of dwelling enjoys special privilege. Where the one who calls us forth is the center, that is, Jesus Christ, our Lord. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas. If we invite you to come forward, and at this point, before we take our break and come back for applications of this presentation, is there any questions or discussions to anything that Dr. Thomas may have said to you that stir something in your heart that you would like to comment or ask a question of? In asking questions, we have microphones around the building, so we would ask that you approach a microphone that we all can hear your questions. Anybody? And in doing so, as you come before the microphone, could you introduce yourself to us by name and where you're from, or student, or pastor, whatever. Thank you.
My name is James Bruner. I'm a student here at Concordia Seminary. I'm a second-year student. And my question is to clarify that I got your message right. And my question is that are you saying that there's a fear of losing identity, not only that fear of what you use, the African American, is that the correct term? Their fear of losing their identity, of their history, and also a fear of white American Lutherans losing their identity. And what you're saying is that the African Americans are losing their identity because we white Americans are not accepting theirs. Let me say what I've written. I'm getting confused here. What I'm asking, is there a stubbornness of white Lutherans to accept the African identity? And so do white Lutherans expect the African Americans to take on the white history as their history, thus losing their own to extinction? Is that what you're trying to say?
Thank you. Yeah, that kind of gets at it. I work under the premise that when two individuals meet, they each have a story to tell. It's some story of all of the experience put together that each of them had. And it would seem to me that the thing for white and black Christians that really unites us is the Jesus story. It's the Christ story. But apart from the Christ story, we each still have experiences out of which we have come. Now, it has often happened, and I go a little bit farther than saying that we lose our identity. I say we have an identity crisis. It's a crisis. We behave in a certain way when we're around each other because we are in crises. And if we don't recognize that and do something about it, we all lose because of it. I don't expect, and I was going to go into that a little bit more in our second session, but I don't expect for white people to become black, no more than I want black people to become white. I think that we can all stay who we are, but become one in Christ. Does that answer the question?
That clarifies that point. And then your discussion about the liturgical contribution of black African Americans, are you saying that's the first step to the white Lutheran acceptance
I spoke a little bit about context. Christianity in the hands of Greeks took on a kind of Paul said to the Greeks, it was a message to the Greeks, and to the Jews, it's a message to the Jews, and to the Romans, it's a message to the Romans, and it becomes quite appropriate to those people in its setting. It's having a difficult time, though, translating to Hispanics and the blacks, and to in the way that we hear Paul talking about it. Contextually, each by each congregation, there are some things that liturgically identify us. There are marks that identify us as Lutheran. There are definite marks that identify us as Lutheran. But then there are some other things that identify us as particular congregations in particular places. For example, contextually, each by each congregation, there are some things that liturgically identify us. There are marks that identify us as Lutheran. There are definite marks that identify us as Lutheran. But then there are some other things that identify us as particular congregations in particular places. For example, I visited Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Minneapolis, where Paul Montz used to hold forth as the organist up there in the loft. That is really a Scandinavian, it's just, the music is incredible. The singing is incredible. They are not doing anything different, but it's that congregation. And I want to tell you that it's different from every other Lutheran congregation in one aspect in Minneapolis. And there are so many Lutheran congregations in Minneapolis, you can't move. That's what I'm talking about. But one would have no problem recognizing where one was in terms of its Lutheran identification marks.
Thank you.
Bill Parson from Southeast District. Not a question, Dr. Thomas, but an affirmation. We have three daughters, adults, who are very Lutheran, but in their travels around the country have had great difficulty finding a church, each one, that would accommodate their style, their desire, their heritage. They bemoan the fact that they want very much to do what you were talking about, but that many churches retain their ethnicity and et cetera, and do not allow for the freedom that they have come to know in their Lutheran development. So I want to thank you for what you've said. In your quiet way, you've said a great and a powerful message today. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. I think I don't have any statistics to back me up on this, but I think we are losing ground with younger blacks, and the only barometer that I have for measuring that is that in the 14 years that I was a pastor in New York City, I counted a whole lot of people who grew up in our churches and were gone. Now that's happening in white congregations too, no doubt about it. But it really shows up quite profoundly in black congregations, which are already tottering.
Rich Dickinson, I appreciated the presentation tremendously. I want to throw out a challenge here. I was agonizing with you over the fact that there was such a dearth of material on black history in this church. And I'm one that agonized over it tremendously. That which I did find was basically black history written by whites about black history. And they did the same thing there that they do in writing the history of the United States. It's the history of the white man in the United States, and the Indian is forgotten. It's a standard practice. So you have to throw that challenge. If you want your history written, you write it yourself. And I think that that's a challenge that we have to pick up and do it. If we want our culture brought into this church, I can't anticipate that white people will bring into a black ministry that which they don't know. If anybody's going to bring it in, the black people who know it will have to bring it in. And I just want to lay that challenge where it ought to be laid.
We're certainly grateful to you for your contribution, Roses and Thorns. And if you saw on the table as you came in, a new book that's called Theology and the Black Experience, the book that is edited by Ambrose Moyo of the University of Zimbabwe and Albert Perot of Clifton School of Theology. It then becomes the second significant book that deals with a Lutheran presence, if you will, in Africa and America. And I would like to ditto what you just said. More of us need to be in the institute and in the library and so forth, digging stuff out.
I'm Tom Laxo from Mount Olive here in St. Louis, and I serve in a gray neighborhood. That's what the demographics call it. I've never found anybody gray in the neighborhood, but that's how they list us. My question is, our church was founded by Richard Kemmerer, who you quoted, and Mount Olive has never had a Germanic tradition of German Lutheranism. We have names like Sullivan and Jones on our roster. And as we search for liturgies that reach to the multi-cultures in our neighborhood, one of the things that we find is a conspicuous absence of black liturgy. We find white liturgies available that reach out to non-Germanic peoples who are Lutheran, but we do not find any, to my knowledge, black liturgies that are available to us. And the second thing that I think that perhaps needs to be mentioned, because one of our greatest outreach into the community is towards the children, is to find things in the Sunday school areas and the vacation Bible school areas that reach to black children. And I just think, and I thank you for your comments, but I think this is something that perhaps is an area that we need to address.
One of the most significant pieces that has been done recently, a very thick book about the size of Lutheran worship, is a book entitled Lead Me, Guide Me. Some of you may be familiar with it. It's been done by Roman Catholic blacks who are talking about the same issue that we talk about. That might be a good starting point for you, but I'd be willing to talk to you at the break about some other things that I'm aware of.
Simon Botley is chaplain here at Institution Ministry. Just a comment to her. As the tradition goes in our black setting, that when the pastor is on target, you hear people saying, "Make it clear, Pastor." And you have made it clear, my brother. It comes through loud and clear. I am kind of a similar, just to verify what you say, after 33 years in the ministry in an all-black church. And that's the only place I want to be, because I feel I can relate to black people. And I don't want to change nobody else. But I want the same thing. Don't come in and try to change me. And I'm not going to try to change you. Now, the thing that we struggle with, my wife and I, after 35 years almost marriage, is trying to hold on to our Lutheran kids. We have 5 kids now. They're all grown. And we moved from Chicago about 2 years ago after 20 years in a parish there. And the struggle we have is they say, "Daddy, the churches we go to don't relate to us." And I just keep saying, and my wife keeps saying, "But you got to hang in there.
But then they said, Daddy, hang on to what? So my thing is, at least what I tried to do in the parish, and I'm not trying to sell it to nobody else, and I think it was successful after 20 years in a church in Chicago, and when I look back, some of you may call it parish, but I don't think I did a bad job. But we didn't deny no gospel there. It wasn't something I learned in the seminary, but I took the culture of the people. Now, of course, I had people there that didn't want that, you know. You always find those in churches. In our black church, I mean. They're always going to show other folks, we are black. They're ashamed of many times who they are. But we made our own hymnal. We had two hymnals in the church. We had a Lutheran hymnal, and we had a black hymnal. And after trying to teach those folks about 10 years, you know, they like to sing those hymns. They keep saying, Pastor, we don't want to sing no 15 and what's that other name? Five. Well, I did have something like that, so I had a special church for them that wanted to say to that 5 and 15. That's the old hymn. I'm not speaking of this new one. I don't know all how to do that. But you're right, Brother Thomas. You've got to do that. And we're going to have to say that to our people. We don't have anything to be ashamed of. And we are not trying to change the culture of the Lutheran. I admire my white brothers for going to churches and preaching what their constituents want. But I have problems with those brothers going to our churches and try to change that culture over to theirs. And I have problems with my people who say to them, right on, Pastor, we aren't over there. So I'm saying to you, you made it clear. Thank you, my brother. You reinforce me. And I'll go back to my institution ministry and keep on doing what I am doing.
Tom Cole from Des Moines, Iowa. And the only thing I can say as a white person here is that I'm an Irish Catholic who became a Lutheran, and I realize there are certain culture changes even for us who are white, who come from different cultures. And I appreciate Lutheranism, and I guess the question that I would ask is, I listen here and struggle myself with trying to adapt to whatever culture I'm ministering to, realizing that there are cultural differences. Outside of the theological definition of the marks of the church as the means of grace and the words and the sacrament, how does the black community see the marks of the Lutheran church, if you could relay that to me?
I think that you shouldn't tell somebody to go read a book when you ask a question. But one good resource is the just mentioned book, Theology in the Black Experience. But I think by the very presence of blacks in the clergy ranks, but also in the dedicated lay ranks of the Lutheran Church, we acknowledge that we are members of this family, of this household, and theologically, we are here. I don't think there's any doubt in our mind about that. There aren't any black Lutheran theologians writing diatribes against doctrinal positions of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod or the ELCA. No, I think that there's some amount of clearness in our hearts and in our minds about the marks of the church, doctrines of the church. No, what we are talking about is the empty pew and the vanishing black Lutheran. That is what I'm most concerned about. I'm very comfortable as a confessional Lutheran. I don't think that I want to be anywhere else. But at the same time, I want my church to be more open and hospitable to the stranger. I want my church to be able to identify in the stranger who comes something that is worthwhile. I want my church to be able to benefit from the blessings that God places in the stranger who comes to my church,
And I don't want it always pretending that it has everything to give. Because I'm too much aware of the fact that God endows us with different gifts and blessings. And he sends people to us with specific packages.
Jack Burns, I'm a white pastor of a white congregation in an increasingly mixed community. I have two concerns. Number one, with regard to the liturgy, the historic hymnology of the church. I said at the time I was at the seminary and near graduation, if I go to urban inner city, I'll throw away the Lutheran hymnal, etc. and so forth. I'm not so sure I would do that today. I would try to build bridges. I would try to provide a variety of things. I fear alienation of those who are not of that group we're trying to target in this particular thing. The black are, I don't want to limit to black. I think we've got the same problem with the Hispanics. We've got the same problem with other minority groups. I do believe that there is a tremendous theological base in our historic liturgy, and I think that if we lose that base in trying to give people worship experience, we're losing something precious. As a convert, it took me 3 years or 4 years to where I even enjoyed the liturgy. Before that, I put up with it for the proclamation from the lectern and from the pulpit. I came to church for the word. And I think our problem as a white pastor is I know how to subjectively judge, fairly decently at least, the application of law and gospel for my contextual cultural background. I do not know how to do it for the black, for the Hispanic, for the person of Asiatic background. And I think that if we will do a better job in that, in the theological task, that we've got more than half the problem whipped. And I'm speaking from a very little experience, except at arm's length with the minority groups. But I don't think that the liturgy is the main issue. I think it is the interpretation and a proper application of historic Christianity, the message. And there is one other element that I run into, and it's not from a white experience, but I have there is an assumption, and I've dealt with more Hispanics, I think, than I have blacks since I got here, that, Pastor, you couldn't speak to me because I'm Hispanic and you're white. But I would say that one thing we do not want to project is the idea that we do not have a message. I think we have to, when you talk about training of black pastors, you better talk about training us, too, to understand the cultural differences that make our judgments harder on how to apply law gospel.
Thank you. Pastor McDaniels and I used to pastor two black Lutheran churches that were about 12 blocks apart in Jamaica, New York. And mine was selected to be on ABC one Easter Sunday morning nationwide. Is that right, James? Yeah. And we were in a little competition there. No, we weren't in competition. But I wanted you to know that people from around the country wrote to us and said that they instantly knew that they were watching a Lutheran service. We didn't throw the green book out just because we wanted to. We weren't going to outdo the Baptists at what they do best. We weren't going to outdo the Pentecostals at what they are natural at doing. But also, what we got was that people were aware, not just because they were looking at all them black people in church, that it was a contextualized experience. It was same, but it was different. I would never say that that the hymn book is where you stop and say, now this is going to be the corrective. No, there are a lot of other issues that have to be confronted.
There are some pastors I've met who believe sincerely in their heart that the liturgy is that final point at which the church ought to find its identification in community. After we have celebrated the liturgy on Sunday morning, there really isn't anything that's important in what we do. And I've often said that if the liturgy is the work of the people, if that's what that word means, then it really doesn't stop at the altar, but it continues in a works of faith in the context that that congregation is in. Let me give you an example of that. I know you want to do how to speak. A young lady came to me in an Advent church in New York City, and she had her baby. She wanted the baby to be baptized, and I had been taught that we don't baptize anybody's baby if they don't belong to church, and my cluster pastors had been reinforcing that you don't just baptize, throw water on any baby, and I said to her, where's your husband? And she said, I don't have a husband. And I don't know precisely who the father is of my child, but it could be one of two or three people. I'm not sure. But I do know that I want my baby baptized. And I said, well, what I'd like to do is talk to you a bit about the faith of the church and the faith in which we baptize. And what I'd like for you to think about before you do that is yourself becoming a part of this church so that you can keep the promises that you will make when you stand at the baptismal font. Because there are some promises that we ask you to commit yourself to. I was kind of embarrassed when I thought about the fact that 4 or 5 years earlier I would have just said no. She brought the baby to be baptized after she joined the church, and about 25 people came to that baptism by invitation because we gave her some invitations to invite 25 people. And out of that 25 people, 4 people, including her mother, joined. And out of that 4 people, 4 more people joined. And it kept kind of working that way until we were up to about 45. But out of the context of that one baptism, we were involved in so much family and social ministry, broken relationship, estrangement, poverty, and so on. It just kept multiplying. Every time one of those persons came forth, they brought with them a wealth of social circumstances. And the liturgy just had to be played out all through their lives. They needed much more than preaching at. I would even become heretical and say they needed much more than communion. Those people needed jobs and a whole lot of other stuff, and that's all communion also.
S.C. Williams, Concordia Seminary, Fort Wayne, first-year student. Should be a little long wait on that. Thank you for your comments earlier. We always hear about black preaching and black styles and how that we need that kind of thing, but we don't have it on our seminary campus. And I'd like to know if you can address the question why we don't have that. I know that gets a little deep, but could you kind of address the question, why don't we have our black ministers teaching us at our seminaries?
So far, I've stayed out of trouble. At least I think so. I don't know.
I enjoy opening doors because it has to be open, and we're here to open some doors and get some things done. So.
Yeah. You know, one of the I was a student here for a while, and one of the things that happened to me when I was a student here was that there were some people on campus who were aware of a great deal of things that were happening around the country vis-a-vis the black community. At the time that I was here, there was a group that was called the National Conference of Black Churchmen. Some of you may remember that name. They later changed their name to Church People.
Pastor McDaniels and I went to a conference in New York, and we were exposed to people like Dr. Colston, who's going to be here tomorrow. Very early on, we were able to see up close some of the legendary black pastors from all sorts of denominations and so forth. Of course, here we were exposed to legendary white pastors, too. But I think that that went a long ways toward helping to give shape and identity to who we became as pastors of the church. I don't know why there aren't more black seminary professors. One of the things you might want to do is go on through and get your doctorate and then go to Fort Wayne and apply for a position, you know.
I don't know. I think why historically we haven't. You don't know, you're saying. And at one time at Fort Wayne there was one black professor.
Professor Collins.
Yeah. Professor Collins. And today there's none. And I will say that the campus needs some. I'm sure the graduates could say they're not there. I hear all the great things about our black ministers and our black Lutheran churches talk about their home churches, but you have to remember we need some assistance there to get to where they are. Okay?
He thinks that Professor Collins was the hardest professor he ever had at the seminary.
That's probably true.
But I think that you should go when you get back to Fort Wayne and have a conference with Dr. Price and ask him. He might give you that.
We had that conference. That's why I'm bringing the question here.
Dave, would you answer that question?
No, I'm going to stay out of trouble because I got a gust up out in the street tomorrow. So, in general, there's a lot of historical reasons for that. Let me first say that at this point, we do have one young man in the person of Reverend Timothy Seals, who is presently studying in California toward his PhD, who upon completion will be hopefully teaching at Concordia Seminary Fort Wayne. We also hope that another individual will be selected very shortly who will also be studying toward his PhD to be available to Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. One of the factors that I keep reminding everyone is that seminary professors don't come out of the sky. You know, they're nurtured, they're trained, they're inspired, and as we can see, some of the reasons why we are in a shortage as far as black pastors is some of the same reasons could also be applied to any type of teaching or theological education, in the sense that if we don't encourage, if we don't support, if we don't open doors that need to be opened, people are not going to be able to come in, because people who get those doors opened by other individuals and by other sources are going to be loyal to those other individuals. I mean, there are thousands of qualified, which I'll talk about tomorrow, but anyway, there are thousands of people, black Lutherans, who are presently serving in many schools and colleges and seminaries across the country, who are Missouri Synod Lutherans, if, again, those opportunities were open to them by our church body, would be in our various schools and colleges, but they're now teaching elsewhere.
Yes, ma'am. David Meggers, graduate student here at Concordia Seminary. During the course of our conversation today, the word context has come up. Could you elaborate just a little bit more on what you mean by contextualization?
Place. I think I'm referring basically to place and to setting. I think you have a German expression that it doesn't parallel, but it gets close, it's Leben. But it's the situation in life that people find themselves in. Basically, it's no mystery.
Okay, let me follow that up then. By contextualization, do you mean the message is a given content and we try and interpret it to the context, or do you mean that the context determines the content of the message?
Well, I think that the context will certainly inform the message. Yeah, I think so. Somehow I don't quite feel that I've finished answering you yet, but you're not going to cry. You're going to be polite, okay?
Homer Digg, Bethany, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Dr. Thomas. In your presentation to the body, I would wonder if you would go back and elaborate for me on the remarks made that there are some people, speaking of blacks, who are worth being honest, but were not lifted up. And in doing so, would that not be a job for us to do, the scholars, the black scholars that we have among us? What I am doing, I'm getting two signals. Are we to go outside to the Methodists, Baptists, and others? Don't we possess the same abilities that the others do? Then if so, shouldn't we be busy about getting some of these saints who have laid a foundation for this church but gone on to glory? You name one whom I'm very familiar with and who is dear to my heart, and that was Dr. Rosa J. Young. I'll stop. I'd like for you to answer that part first.
Well, I think that I find absolutely no argument with place from which you are coming. Yes, we certainly ought to be out front, and that's part of what I'm attempting to do today, up front in lifting up the names of people who are significant in the life of Lutheranism in North America. But at the same time, I think that that white Americans, to be truthful to the commonality that we share in terms of our identification as Lutherans, ought also be quite upfront with saying on the anniversary of the ordination of Yehu Jones that this was the first black pastor ordained in Lutheranism in North America. That should be something that we want to celebrate. I think that we should be up front in just as the Baptists have, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, even the Unitarians, in writing, and Dr. Richard Dickinson has certainly done some of that, some history ourselves. So it's a both and.
Yeah, good. Thank you. I'm aware of the work done by Dr. Richard Dickinson, Sr., Roses and Thorns.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I have in mind. Having been in the Lutheran Church for 47 years, I see that there has been nothing written that much about the history and accomplishment of the blacks within the Lutheran Church. The Synodical Conference back then, and now the Missouri Senate now. I believe that, as you said in the address, there is an identity crisis, and if there is, which I also agree with you that there is an identity crisis, then how do we go about resolving this conflict, this crisis?
Mm-hmm.
In a brotherly way.
You want me to answer?
Because, yes, because what I'm coming to, it seems like rather than being evangelical with one another, we use the term black and white. And as one person went responded, it was afraid to say Afro-American, wondering if that's right. That's correct, because if you go back in history, you'll find out when they brought the slaves over here, that's what they referred to start with, before they started calling them niggers and all these other names, okay? But I want to know, how do we work these problems out together? Because in the closing remarks, you said that in Africa, there were Lutherans, and if they keep growing as they're growing now, there will be more Lutherans in Africa than any place on, well, almost on Earth. And if so, We are of the same blood, and why not? In this country, we can't do the same thing. I'm asking the next question. How can we go about to bring about change? Especially when we say that in all our metropolitan areas and inner cities, most of the population is black. So therefore, where the Lutheran churches are found in these areas, and I happen to be working in one in Milwaukee, how do we go out and change the image of the church and make it Afro-American, Germanic, whatever you want, however you want to make the label, but to make it one that, if you follow what I'm saying, how do we do this?
That's the end of your question?
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's the end of the question.
Okay, yeah. I was just waiting to see if we were at the end. Are we at the end of the hour?
No. You can hold it to the next, but I'd like to have an answer to it.
Well, I think
does my question make sense?
Yeah, sure it does.
Okay,
sure
first does. I want to see if I make sense. If don't, then I back up.
Oh, sure it does.
Okay.
Yes. I think that what we are doing here today in this symposium is a step in that direction. I hope that some people are being sensitized. I'm kind of glad that there are seminarians here today because I appreciated as a seminarian everything that I got. Well, not everything. There were some things I didn't appreciate. everything useful. a lot of the experiences, especially symposia like these experiences, were very helpful as I had to make some decisions in my ministry. They certainly sensitized me to some needs, but also the relationships that I had with other clergy in community outside even of my Lutheran faith group largely instructed and helped me. But I think for each of us individually, a path has to be cut, and we just have to be mindful of our own inequities. I mean, we are still mortal people trying our best to do what is appropriate in the settings that we're in. I said also in the message I presented that I would not presume to give an answer, an overall answer, because I don't have one. But I can ask some questions, and I can try to do some consciousness raising so that you can find some appropriate answers that are appropriate to your setting. That's about the best I could do with that question.
Thank you.
Dr. Thomas, I appreciate your message. We go back a long way. I remember you when you were here at the seminary. I'm deaconess intern Addie Wilkins, having come into this position late in life. I wanted to say that I appreciated what you said, having had the opportunity last year to spend a semester on the campus of one of our colleges, who they said had 70 black students. And I said to them, I'm very sorry, but I doubt if it's 20 on this campus. I had the opportunity to attend worship service at Resurrection Chapel on the Sunday of the weekend of Dr. King's birthday. I went to chapel that Sunday morning. I sat through chapel and I cried all the way through church. And after church was over, I went out and I had the opportunity. I challenged Pastor Brockhoff because he mentioned Dietrich Bonhoeffer and didn't even mention anything about Martin Luther King. And he said to me, well, the kids here don't know anything about Martin Luther King. I said, well, Dr. Brockhoff, my children didn't know anything about George Washington Carver or Abraham Lincoln. and he was a white man, and they were black children. I had to teach them about George Washington Carver. And I said that to say this, that, you know, I'm not going to lose my identity because I'm in the Lutheran Church, because I know who I am. And I know who I stand on. And I know who I believe in. And that is Jesus Christ. And I think our church, no matter whether you're Hispanic, Italian, Germanic, or who you are, the one person that we have in common, our belief and our faith is in Jesus Christ. And we have to believe in him. But one of the things that I want to share is that I attended a lecture last year I was at Valpo with a man by the name of Charles King. And one of the things that he did say, and I found this out because it's just relevant that once we get in an all-white situation, and I've had friends 6 months down the road, they call me on the phone, I almost don't know who they are because their language have changed. So I'm not going to change because I'm in the Lutheran Church. I'm going to say who I am, and I'm going to continue to believe in the man who is above all men, and that's Jesus Christ. One of the things I have struggled with in this church, in the Lutheran Church, that I raised 5 children, and I still only have 2 of them that worship with me on Sunday morning. I would love for it to have been a church that we could have all stayed as a family, because I believe the family that stays together, prays together, stays together.
Amen, Addie.
Pastor Johnson.
Thank you. I'm John Johnson from Redeemer Lutheran Church in Newark, New Jersey. And I guess my statement is more a comment. In listening, I think that there really isn't anyone here who would have any problems recognizing that there is a difference with a black culture, a Hispanic culture, an Asian culture, and that any presentation of the gospel, of our liturgies, of all of these different aspects of ministry require that those differences be taken into account. I guess the concern for myself, and from when I remember being here as a seminarian, is what are the limits to these changes? I hear often, well, we ought to be able to change this, and we should be allowed to change that. That's fine, but what are the limits? I mean, since there are no definitions as to what can be changed, I can rightfully see where there is legitimate cause for concern and for a fellow Christian, whether he is white or black or she is white or black, to say, well, how far is this going to go? Because there is no definition set in this. It's just the idea, well, based on these different cultural aspects, there's changes that need to be made. No argument, how far? And that's just something that was on my mind that we need to consider in this when we go along to make those changes to have Lutheranism grow in non-white situations in the city.
Thank you. We have time for one more question.
Bill Yacker, Berea Lutheran Church in Detroit. And I just need your thoughts and comments on something, and that is something that's been disturbing me. Recently, we celebrated the Black Ministry Sunday, and some flyers were sent out from the commission. And I did not take enough time to read them over ahead of time. They came from Synod. I just expected them to be in good shape. One of them was brought to me by a group of my members. And the statement was this. Said many of our congregations involved in black ministry, and I'm paraphrasing, I realize, are served by white pastors, and I understand that's true. The statement that I believe at the very least was insensitive and at the most a sin was this: that is not in the best interest of the congregation or of the pastors. It shocked me and my congregation. Recently I turned down a call to an all-white church in Kankakee, Illinois. and I presently, me and my wife are the only white members of our church. And I was offended, and I don't know if I'm stepping on toes. I don't know a lot of folks here, and maybe I can become a pariah real quick. And I don't mean to do that, but I was distressed and morally outraged. I agree, the message went to the Romans and to the Jews and to the Greeks, but I also heard my Lord say through the Apostle Paul, there is no Jew nor Greek. And I do not take exception with Brother Bodley over here when he says that there are pastors who want to change congregations. I'm not naive to think that that's not true, but I don't want to do that. And I guess maybe rather than make blanket statements, we need to think a little bit. And I solicit your comments and your thoughts.
Dr. Dickinson wants to make a comment on that. I as the one of the authors to that particular piece, feel I need to make a comment to that. Because I did receive some correspondence from several white pastors primarily who had similar concerns over the words expressed. I believe the statement is made out of context, or again has to be reflective to context, to whom the message is being shared with. I believe that what you share is accurate. Our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ calls us all. There is no discrimination to whom he calls. He calls us whether we're young or old, male or female, white or black, Hispanic, Native American, Asian culture. We all call to the same Lord and to the same salvation. However, in order for that faith to be shared, in order for that faith to be preached, in order for that faith to be nurtured, it is not always in the best interest to people from one culture who refuses to be cognitive and conscious of the culture in which they're serving to go and share and witness that equipping, saving gospel of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ to another culture that in many cases, many of those individuals are not sensitive, again, to what Pastor Thomas was saying, to the context in which they are dealing and relating to. The concern I have, and we will talk more in detail about this tomorrow in my presentation, is if we as a church body, in any seriousness, are going to share the gospel of Jesus Christ,